Today is November 22nd, 2014. Okay, we'll start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. Okay, so last week we had the shorter, the Chula Sunyata Sutta. That's the shorter discourse on emptiness or voidness, according to this translation. And today we take the Maha Sunyata Sutra, that is the greater or longer discourse on voidness, or I prefer emptiness. Okay, this is a fairly difficult sutta in several ways. It's difficult to understand. And also I have to say that the image of the Buddha that comes across in this sutta is not like the smiling, jolly, jovial, plump, good-natured fellow that one usually thinks of, but he comes across as rather stern and strict and demanding in this sutta. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha is living in his own native land, the Sakyan country, at Kapalavattu in a monastery that is called Nigrodha's Park. Okay, so the text tells us that in the morning the Blessed One dressed, he took his alms bowl and his outer robe, and he went into Kapalavattu on alms round. Okay, then when he had wandered for alms in the city and then returned from his alms round, then after his meal, he went for his daytime abiding to the dwelling of Kala Kaimaka, the Sakyan. And according to the commentary, this dwelling of Kala Kaimaka, this was a building that a Sakyan named Kala Kaimaka had set up at Nigrodha's Park as an accommodation for the monks. And so the text says that on that occasion there were many resting places prepared in Kala Kaimaka, the Sakyan's dwelling. So the commentary says that in this dwelling, many beds had been set up very close to each other so that many monks could live there at a single time. And so when the Buddha saw this, then he thought that there are many dwelling places prepared in this dwelling, and he was wondering, do many monks live here? It's interesting that the narration of the sutta tells us what the Buddha was thinking. And that raises the question, how does the narrator know what the Buddha was thinking? Did the Buddha tell somebody, this is what I was thinking on that occasion? Anyway, I don't have the answer to that question, but it's, as I was reading the sutta again, it struck me. How does the narrator know this? Okay, then the text continues that on that occasion, the Venerable Ananda, along with many other monks, was busy making robes at another dwelling located at that monastery. This was the dwelling that had been set up by another Sakyan by the name of Gata. Okay, so when it was evening, the Buddha got up from his daytime retreat and he went to the dwelling built by the Sakyan Gata, and he sat down on the seat made ready, prepared for him, and he asked the Venerable Ananda, he said that there are many resting places prepared in Kala Kema's dwelling place. Are many monks living there? And then Ananda said that many monks are living there. This is our time for making robes, Venerable Sir. So this must be the period, usually after the rains retreat. That is when lay people will provide the monks with pieces of cloth for making robes. And generally in those days, the early days, the monks would make the robes themselves. Lay people would simply provide pieces of cloth, and the monks would have to cut them according to prescribed measurements, sew them, the pieces of cloth together according to a proposed design, and then they have to dye the robes. And so it's a rather long, drawn-out process, time-consuming, and generally, to make the work go more easily, many monks work together on this project. In fact, this is still done in forest monasteries in Thailand, perhaps Sri Lanka. I don't know whether it's still done.
Well, the katina.
Yeah, but the katina, they usually give now a ready-prepared robe, commercially prepared robe. But in the old days, they didn't have commercially prepared robes, so they would have to make the robes themselves from pieces of cloth. Nowadays, in a country like Sri Lanka, there are what they call dharma shops.
Also,
what?
Excuse
me?
In Sri Lanka, the temples here, the people sew.
People sew the robes?
Yeah, not the monks.
Yeah, he said the people sew the robes, not the monks. But in Thailand, I know that in the forest monasteries, the monks have to learn sewing, and they have to sew their own robes.
And
Mitarigala,
they sew their own robes.
And Mitarigala, yeah, so there are places where the monks still sew their own robes. That was the way that was originally laid down in the Vinaya. So the Buddha did allow what they call ready-made robes. And so, as I was saying, now, at least in Sri Lanka, they have dharma shops where you can go and you can choose the different colors according to monks in different temples, monasteries like different colors, or sometimes individual monks prefer different colors. So if you know that monk likes dark robe, you get a brown robe for that monk. If these monks wear the bright orange robes, you get a bright orange robe for those monks. And you can also buy in the dharma shops incense, meditation supplies, little dagobas, miniature dagobas. What do they call them? Kalanduva?
Karanduva.
And Buddha, of course, Buddha statues, pieces for setting up an altar. As Suki is smiling, she used to have it. She used to have a dharma shop in, what was that place, the town in New Jersey?
The shopping mall.
Rockaway, New Jersey?
Rockaway and then Riverside Square.
Riverside Square. Okay, so at this time, the monks have gathered together and they're preparing the robes. And now the Buddha gives a rather stern admonition to the monks. He says, Ananda, a monk does not shine by delighting in company, by taking delight in company, by devoting himself to delight in company, by delighting in society, by taking delight in society, by rejoicing in society. It seems that what was happening was, at the time, as the monks had gathered together to prepare their robes, you know, naturally, one monk will start talking to the others, bring up some topic of conversation, not relating to the Dharma, maybe just some worldly topic of conversation. You know, did you hear King Pasenadi has a new concubine? Then another monk will say, well, what does the Queen Malika think about that? Oh, she was seemed to be very patient, but I think she must have been really upset about that. And another monk says, what does the new concubine look like? Is she beautiful? And then the other monk says, oh, man, she's out of this world. Long, flowing hair, bright, shiny eyes. And another monk says, from where does she come? Oh, she comes from maybe the city of Ayodhya. What are her relations? Oh, she comes from this family. And then, you know, the conversation goes on until they're talking about maybe there takes place the old Indian wrestling matches. You know, who's going to be in the wrestling match? Oh, it's going to be Ravindra is going to be wrestling against, what's good, Nihil. So I'm using Sri Lankan names, but they're similar to Indian names. Who do you think is going to win the wrestling match? Oh, I bet, well, they don't have money to bet, but I think Ravi is going to win. No. Doesn't stand a chance. Nihil is such a better wrestler than Ravi is. Okay, so then they start engaging in worldly talk like that. This is what I'm speculating. And so it's not that the Buddha is being antisocial, but the Buddha is speaking about the kind what happens when groups of people get together. Then this tendency is for people to start engaging in worldly conversation. And where does worldly conversation come from? Where does it come from? Out of space?
Delusions.
What?
Delusions.
Well, I was thinking more broadly.
Getting together.
No, it comes from the worldly thoughts. And so, in a way, you could say that the Buddha's way of instruction was built upon, well, the Buddha's way of teaching was built on a tension between two elements. One element is that, quite contrary to many of the contemporary ascetics of his period, the Buddha didn't just live as a kind of lone hermit, occasionally just teaching people who came his way. You know, just wandering from town, to city, teaching, then departing all alone with just a small band of followers. But the Buddha created a sangha, and the word sangha means literally it's joining together or joined together. Those who have joined together in order to follow the Buddha. And so the Buddha established a monastic sangha governed by very specific rules and regulations, and he attracted thousands of followers who followed him into the homeless life. And so the Buddha joined them together to create a monastic order, probably along with the Jains, the first monastic order in the world. And it's an order that survived right down to the present day. And then the Buddha, in establishing the monastic order, he emphasized the importance of monks living together in community. And for this, to ensure that the community flourishes, the Buddha laid down certain regulations. For example, that junior monks should stay under the supervision of senior monks. And so even a newly ordained monk has to stay under the supervision of a senior monk, his teacher, for 5 years. And for newly ordained nuns, a similar regulation. Actually, nuns have 3-year period of apprenticeship, but that's because they have to spend 2 years before they take the ordination. So you take the 2 years of novice status and the 3 years of apprenticeship, so it's also 5 years for nuns. And the Buddha also emphasized the importance of what's called kalyanamitta. That means having good friends, so that those who live the spiritual life should not just pursue it as a solitary endeavor, but the Buddha says you should always associate with good friends, with spiritual friends. Always seek out the guidance of good friends. And it's the function of the good friend to give advice, instruction, encouragement, consolation when one is feeling discouraged, correction if one is doing something wrong. And he said it's only when a monk becomes, or a monastic person becomes, well established in the Dhamma that they're ready to go off into solitude. And yet the Buddha, that's one side of the tension, that the Buddha says creates a sangha, emphasizes the importance of good friendship, instructs the monastic persons to seek out the instruction and guidance of teachers, and also the Buddha teaches for lay Buddhists to come together as good friends of one another, to be united in their faith, virtuous behavior, understanding of the Dhamma, practicing generosity together, discussing the Dhamma together. And yet on the other hand, he teaches pavavita sayang dhammo nayang dhammo sanghanikara massa. That is, this Dhamma is for one who is fond of seclusion, fond of solitude, not for one who is fond of company or society. And so, to advance in the practice, the Buddha emphasizes the importance of, sometimes it's called paviveka or viveka. The word viveka is what's usually translated as seclusion, or could also be rendered as separation. And then it's in the text that sometimes distinguished as threefold, three kinds of seclusion. First is bodily seclusion, or physical seclusion, which means going off into a solitary place, a secluded place, you know, separating oneself from the noise and bustle of society and coming to a quiet, secluded place for practice. Usually in the monasteries they have a meditation hall. This is the monasteries in the West, where many people can practice meditation together. But even if one is sitting on a seat with people sitting to your left and right, in front and behind, but because there's generally a rule of noble silence prevailing, so even if there are other people around, because of the rule of noble silence, you could say that you're practicing kaya viveka by separating from the others. But in many of the monasteries, like in Sri Lanka, the meditation monasteries, even though they might have a central meditation, small meditation hall, but for the monks they have what they call kudis. These are little huts. Actually, some of them are more than huts. They're quite nice structures. Just, they could be made out of stone or out of stones, or sometimes made out of wood. And it'll just be one central room where, with a bed, maybe off to the side, a little room, just enough space for sitting and meditation. And then a walkway, sometimes a covered walkway. And so in a monastery that covers a large area, there'll be kudis spread out over that area, on the hillside, down below. Sometimes they're separated so that you can't even, from one kuti, you can't even see the other kutis. Okay, and so when you're staying in the kuti, then one really gets a very nice feeling of seclusion. So this is bodily seclusion. And then based on bodily seclusion, one next has to develop what's called citta viveka, that is seclusion of the mind. That is usually when we go into physical seclusion, the mind is still overrun by distracting thoughts, especially by thoughts governed by the five hindrances. And so one has to train the mind to gain seclusion of mind, that is the separation of the mind from distracting thoughts, from the defiled thoughts. And usually this will mean that, you know, the higher level, the attainment of the jhanas or meditative absorptions. And then based on citta viveka, that is seclusion of the mind, then one has to develop or attain upadhi viveka. That means the seclusion, complete seclusion from the mental defilements. It's the ultimate elimination of the mental defilements. Okay, and so the ultimate purpose for which the Buddha teaches the Dhamma, one could say, is the upadhi viveka. That is the seclusion from the mental defilements. And in order to reach this seclusion, one needs seclusion of mind, the separation of the mind, at least temporarily, from being overrun by disturbing and distracting thoughts, from the five hindrances. And then for most people to achieve seclusion of mind, it's necessary to go into physical seclusion by going on retreat, by entering into a secluded place and devoting oneself to the practice of meditation. Okay, so So continuing, the Buddha says, indeed, Ananda, it isn't possible that a monk who delights in company, takes delight in company, and devotes himself to delight in company, and so on, will ever obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. And this, according to the commentary, is referring to the attainment of the jhanas. Even though the jhanas themselves are not really a state of enlightenment, but here they're called the bliss of enlightenment because they give a foretaste of the real bliss of enlightenment. Okay, and then the Buddha continues and says, it can be expected that when a monk lives alone, withdrawn from society, he will obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. Okay, then to underscore the same point, the Buddha now expresses it from a somewhat, or using somewhat different terminology. Again, he says, I'm in paragraph 4 now, it isn't possible that a monk who delights in company, takes delight in company, and so forth, will ever enter upon and abide in either the deliverance of mind that is temporary and delectable, or in the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. But it can be expected that when a monk lives alone, withdrawn from society, he will enter and dwell in the deliverance of mind that's temporary and delectable, and in the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. So here, the Buddha is speaking about two kinds of liberation of mind. This is chaito vimutti. Both terms are based on the word samaya. Samaya means a period of time or an occasion. So the one that's samayika, that's temporary. That is, it just lasts for a certain period of time. But it's still called here delectable or desirable because it's blissful and peaceful, serene. And this would be the kind of temporary deliverance of mind that's attained through the meditative absorptions, the jhanas, or the formless attainments. Is it transmitting? Is it working, the live stream? Oh, it is?
It's working, just the sound isn't there.
Okay, so the kind that's temporary, that is contrasted with the kind which is asamayika, that which doesn't last just for an occasion, but this is the permanent liberation of mind. And it's called a kuppa, which means unshakable, that it cannot ever be lost. And so we might identify the temporary liberation of mind with seclusion of mind, citta viveka, and the perpetual, unshakable liberation of mind can be identified with seclusion from the defilements, permanent seclusion from the defilements. And so here the Buddha is stressing that in order to achieve either kind of liberation of mind, it's necessary to go off into seclusion rather than always to be associating with others, to be delighting in company. You know, from a practical standpoint, I don't think that we should all become, you know, inwardly withdrawn hermits, not talking to anybody else. But one should be friendly and sociable with others, be willing to engage with others in friendly ways. But it's also necessary to sort of preserve areas of one's life in which one is ready to, you know, withdraw from active engagement with others and turn inward in order to cultivate one's spiritual faculties. You know, somebody who's just always, they call the social butterfly, somebody who's always has to be connected with others, always has to be talking with others. A person like that has a restless mind and unable to quiet that restless mind. If they're going to quiet the restless mind, one has to be able to enjoy silence, solitude, detachment from outward activities. But sometimes one has to deal with people according to their individual or personal idiosyncrasies. Like if there's somebody who's too much withdrawn, person who always stays by themselves, sometimes it's necessary to force that person to associate with others so that they can break down that kind of the barriers that they put up between themselves and others. That's my personal opinion. But somebody who constantly has to be associating with others, that's the kind of person who has to be told to go off into solitude, into seclusion. Anybody have any questions at this point? Shall we go on then? Okay, now the Buddha says, again, this seems like a strong statement, but he says, I do not see even a single kind of form, Ananda, from the change and alteration of which there would not arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who lusts for it and takes delight in it. So this is flowing in the same direction as the previous statement, that it's through attraction to form that people, at least that's one of the reasons that people come together and associate. And so the Buddha is pointing out that it's through that attachment to form and taking delight in form that one sets up future suffering for oneself, because inevitably there's going to be parting and separation from all forms. And if one has strong clinging to forms, then when the form one is attached to separates, passes away, then there arises sorrow and grief. Then the Buddha continues, he says, however, Ananda, there is this abiding discovered by the Tathagata. And the word that's translated here, discovered, is actually in Pali, it's abhisambuddho, which the base of it is the word buddho, which means awakened or enlightened. So I think the translation as discovered is rather weak. It doesn't bring out the connection with the word Buddha as a designation for the teacher. So the Buddha is called Buddha, the enlightened one or the awakened one, because he has abhisambuddho, he has discovered or realized, awakened to, become enlightened to certain things. And here he's saying that he's become awakened to, or he's become enlightened to, a particular way of dwelling, a particular state. And he describes this state as to enter and abide in voidness, or better, emptiness, internally by giving no attention to all signs. This is a little bit obscure, the expression, all signs. But I think the word that's translated signs becomes more intelligible maybe if we simply translate it as objects. So by not, you know, it doesn't mean we have a sign, go slow, a sign, stop, or a sign, wrong way, no vehicles allowed, or a sign, parking 2 hours only on weekdays, all other times vehicles will be towed away at owner's expense. Not signs in that sense, but these are nimitta here in the sense of, I think the older sense of nimitta is simply objects. So not giving attention to any objects, external objects or even inner objects of thought, but instead entering and abiding in emptiness internally. And so then the Buddha goes on and he says that, and according to the commentary, the Buddha introduces this passage because in some of the people that he's speaking to, the thought might come up, the criticism, that here the Buddha is urging the disciples to go into seclusion, not to enjoy company, but they see the Buddha, you know, hundreds of people are coming to listen to his discourses, and sometimes princes are coming to visit him, and merchants are coming to visit him, and Brahmins are coming to visit him. And so he's always surrounded by monks and nuns and lay people and royalty. And so they say that they'll be thinking, why doesn't the Buddha follow his own advice? Why does he tell others to enjoy solitude, but we never see him alone? And so the Buddha says that While the Tathagata is abiding thus, he is visited by monks or nuns, by men or women lay followers, by kings or their ministers, by the teachers from other sects and their disciples. Then, with a mind leaning to seclusion, tending and inclining to seclusion, withdrawn, delighting in renunciation, and altogether finished with things that are the basis for the asavas, that is, for the taints or defilements, he invariably talks to them in a way concerned with dismissing them. Again, this sounds pretty stern. You know, like, one would think, I go to see the Buddha, I would expect him to say, Bhante, I was expecting you for such a long time. Take a seat. Stick around. You like some tea? Have some tea. Take another cup of tea. What have you been doing these days? And so on. But here the Buddha says, even when he's talking to people, maybe giving them advice and guidance, maybe talking for a whole hour with them, but his mind is always inclining to seclusion. And then at a certain point, he'll say, okay, Bhante, you go. So he's talks to them in a way concerned with dismissing them. Uyoj, the Pali is Uyojanika Patisangyutang Yeva Katam Kata Holti. He's one who gives a talk which is connected with or concerned with dismissing them. Okay, now the Buddha is going to come to the main topic of the discourse, at least one of the main topics. So he's going to give advice to the monk, how that monk could enter into voidness internally. Well, first, what is meant, what does the Buddha mean when he speaks about abiding in voidness internally by giving no attention to all objects? Okay, this voidness that the Buddha dwells in, or this emptiness, is called, technically, it's called the fruition attainment of arahatship based upon the empty nature of nibbana or nirvana. And so there are different kinds of meditative attainments. And this attainment is the fruition attainment of the highest path. That is the path of arahatship, which the Buddha is also arahat, in that he's achieved this path that has eradicated all the defilements, all the obstructions of the mind. And the achievement of that path opens up a particular meditative state called the fruition attainment, the fruition attainment of arhatship, in which the object of experience in that meditative state is nibbana itself, as the unconditioned state. And nibbana can be experienced or enjoyed according to three different qualities of nibbana. These three qualities are the signless, the desireless, and emptiness. Okay, so these are the three ways in which Nibbana is experienced within this meditative attainment, which is called the fruition attainment of arhatship. So it depends upon the particular approach one takes to entering that meditative attainment that will determine the particular aspect of Nibbana that the mind will focus upon. It said, this is according to later texts, that if one focuses upon, or if one develops the contemplation of impermanence, then one enters upon the fruition attainment, taking Nibbana as the signless. If one enters the attainment through contemplating dukkha, suffering, or the unsatisfactory nature of things, then one enters the fruition attainment, focusing upon Nibbana as the desireless. And if one enters the attainment by contemplating the non-self nature, the selfless nature of phenomena, then one enters the experience, one enters the attainment, focusing upon Nibbana in its aspect of emptiness or voidness. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to give instructions to the monk, or to the monks, how to enter.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So if one obtains the first fruit,
yeah,
they're not able to use these objects for meditation.
Actually, it said that even the stream enterer can enter into each attainment, each level has its corresponding fruition attainment. But in the lower fruition attainments, Nibbana doesn't become perfectly clear. It's still like, maybe compare it to looking at the full moon with different layers of clouds. So maybe for us who are ordinary people, the moon is completely concealed by thick clouds so that we don't even see the moon. For the stream enterer, it's like, there are still like three layers of clouds covering the moon. For the once returner, one more layer has been removed. So there's two layers of clouds covering the moon. For the non-returner, there's still one layer of cloud covering the moon. And then for the arhatship, it's like the wind has blown away the last layer of clouds, and so now the moon is standing out against the dark sky.
So only one of these characteristics has to be realized in order to attain Nirvana?
One enters into it by focusing upon one characteristic or the other.
Right.
But I would think that a meditator who's reached Nibbana can choose which one he wants to focus on. So he could do, you know, it's not that he's confined always to the same doorway of realization. But if he wants to go into the signless, he could do that. The desireless, he could do that. The emptiness, he could do that. Okay, so now the Buddha continues with the direct instructions. Now he's giving the direct instructions. So he says, if a monk should wish, may I enter and abide in voidness or emptiness internally, he should steady his mind internally, quiet it, that is, settle it down, bring it to singleness, or unify it, and concentrate it or collect it. So here the Buddha is emphasizing like the first step to entering into emptiness is to develop strong samadhi, concentration. And so this is done through this process. We have four words here, which seem to be moving to stronger, each word seems to be stronger than the previous one. So first one has to steady the mind. Then quiet it down or settle it, then unify it, and then focus it. Okay, then comes the formula for the four jhanas. So, secluded from sensual pleasures, from unwholesome states, he enters and dwells in the first, second, third, and fourth jhana. So that is how one steadies the mind, settles it down, unifies it, and concentrates it. Then he gives attention to voidness internally. So what is meant here by giving attention to voidness internally? Okay, the sutta itself, this is a little puzzling and problematic. This sutta itself doesn't give an explanation of what is meant, but to get some idea of what is intended, well, first the commentary says that by this giving attention to voidness internally, what is meant is contemplating one's own five aggregates as being not self, not the belongings of a self. And there's support for that in another sutta that comes much earlier in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is sutta number 43. On page 394. And if we go to paragraph or section number 33, this is a discussion between the Venerable Sariputta and his friend, I think it could be his cousin or his uncle, the monk named Mahakotita. And they raise the question, what is the deliverance of mind or liberation of mind through voidness or emptiness? And then the answer is given, here a monk gone to the forest, the root of a tree or an empty hut, reflects thus, this is empty of a self or of what belongs to a self. And this would refer to probably to the one's own five aggregates. And so one would contemplate bodily form is not the self, not the property of a self. Feelings, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness are not the self, not the property of the self. And so in this way, one gets the perception of emptiness with regard to one's own five aggregates. And at the same time that this contemplation is discerning the emptiness of the five aggregates, the mind has the backing. Now, this is sort of building up insight on the foundation of the four jhanas. So the mind is very calm, very peaceful, very settled, focused, strongly concentrated. And so the insight into the selfless nature of the aggregates, coupled with that peacefulness and focus of the mind through the jhanas, generates a very powerful experience of inward emptiness. Okay, but now in the case that the Buddha is discussing here, he continues by saying, while the monk is giving attention to emptiness internally. His mind does not enter into emptiness internally or acquire confidence, steadiness, and decision or resolution. Okay, when that is so, he understands thus, while I am giving attention to emptiness internally, my mind does not enter into emptiness internally or acquire confidence, steadiness, and resolution. In this way, he has full awareness of that. And the word that's used here, I don't actually like the translation, full awareness. I prefer clear comprehension. The Pali word is sampajana. So it's a clear knowledge, clear understanding, clear comprehension, clear awareness that his mind is not able to enter into emptiness. And this is very important because even if one can't enter into it, at least one has the clear recognition that one hasn't entered into it. And we'll see that this theme of clear comprehension is repeated again and again throughout this discourse. And so if one has the clear comprehension that one hasn't entered into it, what will be the special benefit of that? What kind of benefits come from this clear comprehension?
Freedom from delusions.
Yeah, that's a very important. Of course, it's very easy, well, maybe not so easy, but it often happens. Sometimes, you know, I've seen people, they just sit and do a little meditation, then they'll come out and say, oh, that dwelling in emptiness was so peaceful, so blissful. And, you know, after a while, one gets a sense of where a person's head is at, as, you know, we use that expression. And you can see that the person is just sort of being boastful and self-deluded, overestimating their capacities. Okay, so one benefit is that it helps one to avoid delusions about one's attainment, one's experience. You know, just if the mind gets a little peaceful when one is doing meditation, don't immediately jump to the conclusion, oh, I've attained the inner dwelling in voidness. I must be close to Buddhahood. And what is the other benefit, related benefit? Just the other side of the coin.
Wisdom. Wisdom arises. There is no solution.
Not quite. I mean, of course, there will be that wisdom in the sense of non-delusion, but something like more directly connected with the theme that's being developed here.
He knows that the work is not complete.
Yeah, he knows that there's more work to be done to enter into voidness internally. So he knows that he has to make a further effort. Okay, so now the Buddha continues, he gives attention to voidness, to emptiness externally. Okay, again, according to the commentary, this would be done by contemplating the five aggregates of others as being void or empty of a self or of what belongs to a self. Though I would give it even a wider interpretation, not only the five aggregates of other people, but everything external to oneself as being empty of a self or anything belonging to a self. I think there's a sutta, well, there is a sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. This would be chapter 35. It's the chapter on the six sense bases. It could be sutta number 85, 86, somewhere around there, in which Ananda comes to the Buddha and he says, there is a saying, Venerable, the world is empty, the world is empty. In what sense is the world empty? Then the Buddha says, the I is empty of a self or anything belonging to a self. Forms are empty of a self or anything belonging to a self. The ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and tastes, the body and tactile sensations, the mind and mental objects are all empty of a self and anything belonging to a self. So here we have both the internal and the external being empty of being empty. So that is actually what comes next. He gives attention to emptiness internally and externally. That is, his own five aggregates and everything externally, alternating between one and the other, trying to contemplate them alternately as being empty of a self and of anything belonging to a self, and then merging the two, the internal and the external, trying to see them simultaneously, empty of a self and what belongs to a self. Then everything is repeated. He's not able to succeed, and so he fully understands, he has this clear comprehension. Okay, then the next part of the exposition, he gives attention to what is called imperturbability. This is a technical term which refers to the formless meditative states or the non-material attainments. That is, what lies beyond the four jhanas are the four formless meditations. The base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And so to make the mind even more quiet, more peaceful, and to make the samadhi even stronger than in the four jhanas, one would advance into the imperturbable attainments or the formless meditations. Okay, and so here the same procedure is described. When he is giving attention to imperturbability, again, his mind does not enter into it or acquire confidence, steadiness, and decision. Okay, when that is so, he understands this. He understands that he's not able to enter it. And in this way, he has full understanding or full awareness of that, or clear comprehension. Okay, now the Buddha is going to explain what to do to advance further when one comes across this stumbling block, this barrier that one can't break through. What is the procedure to be adopted? So he says, then that monk should steady his mind internally quiet it or settle it down, bring it to singleness, unify it, and concentrate it or collect it or focus it on that same sign of concentration as before, that same object of meditation. So here we have the case where the monk was able to gain the jhanas, as mentioned in section 8, but he couldn't pass beyond the jhanas, either into realization of emptiness internally and externally through insight, or passing beyond to the formless, non-material meditative states. So what he should do is to concentrate on that same sign or that same object of concentration as before. So this means, according to the commentary, that he goes back to the same meditative object that he used to attain the jhanas and continues to develop the jhanas to strengthen the jhanic attainment in order to make the power of concentration stronger than it was previously. So it could be that the monk didn't yet have a strong enough base of concentration to penetrate into emptiness or to go to the formless, imperturbable meditations. So this is a way of building up strength in order to be able to overcome the barrier. Maybe it's a little bit like a weightlifter who has been lifting weights, and I don't know, what are the weights that one uses? 50 pounds? Is that too little or too much? I don't know. It's a lot? Okay, so 25 pounds. Okay, he's working with 25 pounds weights. Well, let's say 20 pounds. Okay, 20 pounds. Then he thinks, okay, let me go on to 25 pounds. And then he tries with 25 pounds. He finds it too hard. Or maybe he jumps to 30 pounds, make it really challenging. So he can't do 30 pounds. So he has to go back and continue to practice lifting 20 pounds, do it continuously, maybe over another month or a couple of weeks, till he makes his muscles stronger. Then he can take the 25 pounds and then go on to the 30 pounds. Where it's like somebody is a musician and maybe he's practicing scales and very simple little sonatas by, maybe early sonatas by Mozart. Then he thinks that he'll do maybe a sonata by Beethoven, and it's too difficult. He can't succeed on it because too many note changes. So he has to go back and again practice the scales and practice going to gradually more complex sonatas till he could do some of the more complex Beethoven sonatas. Or somebody is studying Pali and they begin with simple little suttas from Anguttara Nikaya, and then they think that they can take up the Visuddhimagga and read the Visuddhimagga, but it's too difficult. And so what you have to do is to build up, you know, by reading many more suttas and going from the Anguttara Nikaya, which has a lot of short, simple suttas, to longer narrative suttas, like in the Majjhima Nikaya. And then later one can read the Visuddhimagga. And so one has to build up the strength gradually through going back, the Buddha says, to that same object of concentration as before. Okay, then after he's built up the meditative strength, then he gives attention to voidness internally, that is, by contemplating the personal five aggregates as being not self, not the belongings of a self. And while he is giving attention to voidness or emptiness internally, his mind enters into emptiness internally and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. So this is success. Okay, so when he achieves the success, then he understands what's happened, and again, you see, he has full awareness or clear comprehension of that. So now that he's succeeded, he knows that he succeeded. Then he gives attention to emptiness externally by contemplating the aggregates of others or all external objects, forms, sounds, odors, everything external, as being not the self, not the belongings of a self. And then he gives attention to emptiness both internally and externally, alternating between one and the other quickly, and then bringing them together so that one can get the internal and external emptiness simultaneously. And when he does this, then he succeeds, and then he goes on to the imperturbable, that's the formless meditations, and succeeds. And when he succeeds, then again he has sampajanya, he has clear comprehension, full awareness of that. Okay, now we'll take some questions. Barbara?
The difference between paying attention to and the mind entering any of these things.
Paying attention to the what's called the sign of concentration?
Well, yeah, we'll take that. But what's the difference between paying attention to the object of...
I see. Giving attention
it's
to void...
It's a whole list of you give attention to,
yeah.
But the mind doesn't enter, and then now we're...
Okay. That's a good question.
So what's the difference?
Yeah, the difference between paying attention or giving attention to emptiness internally, and then entering into.
Yes.
Okay, giving attention to emptiness internally would be contemplating one's aggregates, one's five aggregates, as being not the self, not the belongings of a self. You know, applying that sanya, the perception of non-self, to the aggregates, contemplating them through the lens of the idea of non-self. But when the actual perception or understanding or insight into non-self arises in relation to the aggregates, then there comes an actual discernment of their emptiness. And then one is able to allow the mind, it's hard to express it except by using metaphor, to enter into that emptiness. Because the emptiness is, in this case, it's an absence of anything. So it sort of lets the mind sort of merge with that empty nature of the five aggregates, or the emptiness that emerges as discerned within the five aggregates. And so it becomes a kind of, it's a meditative, it's a state of samadhi, concentration, in which the object of realization is the emptiness or selfless nature of the five aggregates. So it arises from insight, but it's where the insight becomes so strong and steadily established that, again, the mind can merge with that sense of emptiness.
So in other contexts, it might be the difference between observing the tree and being the tree. mentally?
Well, one can't, not quite, because one can't become the tree.
Okay.
But let me say, use a different analogy. Maybe it's like trying to perceive the moon when the moon is behind the clouds, and then catching sight of the moon. And as one catches sight, the moon emerges from the clouds, and then one sort of lets the mind rest upon the perception of moon and almost settle into that perception, almost as though it's merging with the perception of moon. But of course, the mind doesn't actually become the moon, just like you don't become the tree. Okay, Suki and David, did you have your hand? Yeah.
Like from the change and alteration of which there nourish, can you?
I understand it's a bit convoluted English. Let me see if I could put this another way. I would put it this way. If one lusts after and takes delight in any form, from its change and alteration, there will inevitably arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Does that make it clearer? Or maybe since the Buddha's saying what he's saying is what I see, so maybe we would start, as I see it, if one lusts after and takes delight in any single form, with its change and alteration, there will inevitably arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. That makes it clearer?
Yes.
Any further questions? Okay, then we'll break now for lunch, and we'll come back at 12:30 for discussion, question and answer and discussion. Next week, we don't have a class because it's the Thanksgiving period and there's the meditation retreat here. If anybody wants to attend and you haven't registered, you can register at the office up the hill. The next class will be the following Friday. The following Saturday, that will be December 6th. And we take the rest of the sutta on that day. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the deities, the nagas, the Buddhas or fear spirits, and all beings, wishing them to be well and happy. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang param. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakai upapanna rupi arupicha asanya sanyino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibbutin. Okay, then we end with three half bows to the Buddha.